Welcome to Hadar's Web, a podcast featuring community conversations on spirituality, healing, justice, and art. My name is Hadar Cohen. I am your host, and I am delighted to invite you to my relational web.
We have the great pleasure of being here with Ariella Aisha Azulay. Ariella Aisha is an author, curator of anti-colonial archives, film essayist, and theorist of photography. She is a professor of modern culture and media and comparative literature at Brown University. Azulay is of Algerian and Palestinian descent and identifies as a Muslim Jew, which she powerfully unpacks in her article, Unlearning Our Settler Colonial Tongues. Ariella Aisha recently completed a children's story, Gold Threads, based on an early 20th century strike led by jewelers and gold spinners, acting also as guardians of the Muslim and Jewish world in Fez, Morocco. Azulay's newest book project is Algerian Letters, The Jewelers of the Ummah, and its companion film, The World Like a Jewel in the Hand. This conversation is a joint episode with Hadar's Web podcast, featuring community conversations on spirituality, healing, justice, and art. And Ariella Aisha is interviewed by both me and by mystic artist and educator, Hadar Cohen. Welcome, Ariella Aisha, and welcome, Hadar.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's such an honor and pleasure to be here. I feel that I have, the great honor of interviewing you, Ariella. I've been following your work for a long time. And as an Arab Jew myself, who's also an artist, educator, I feel like I've been so inspired by all the work that you've put out. And I wanted to just start by welcoming you and asking you, what brought you to doing the work that you are doing today? And how did you arrive to being this brilliant scholar, curator, filmmaker, this multi-dimensional, intersectional person?
So first of all, thank you, Dara and Thaya Masher. I'm really delighted to be here in conversation with you. And thank you for this, introduction. I don't know exactly what led me to this. I can speculate about different moments of beginning, but I may start from the last one, which goes back 10 years ago when my father passed away. And, the three daughters, we were, at home and we were a little bit lost. And we looked at, very boring documents because we had to settle, some bureaucratic questions. And we discovered that actually the name of my grandmother is Aisha and not Alice, as my father used to say. And this was mind-blowing in a way, but it felt also like a gift. So from the three sisters, I am the youngest, and I said, this is my name, the name that was not given to me. It's the name that I take. So it opened up, a possibility to think about myself, not only through the name that was given to me, but through the name that I can reclaim. So I think that this was the moment of beginning of doing the work that I'm doing now, which is exploring the destruction of the Jewish Muslim world from the perspective of how it can be reclaimed, not a kind of, lost world like we have been told it is. And I relate to this as a moment of, beginning, because inhabiting the name of Aisha, I saw other things that I couldn't see when I was, inhabiting or, part of the name Ariella for many, many years. So it felt like a beginning, but whatever I explored, the books that I read, the research that I did, I didn't know what to do with it. But I continued. And I wrote in the meantime, my book, Potential History, which in retrospect feels to me like, 10 years of rehearsal to write what I wrote later, which is the Jewelers of the Ummah, the Algerian Letters. So I think that this was my beginning, my endless beginning, one of my endless beginnings to engage with this material.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah, you know, it's funny, in Judaism, we say that there isn't actually a beginning because it's all ever evolving. But thank you for sharing that story. I really relate because so much of my process started when my grandmother passed away and wanting to reclaim her name and her memory. I mean, my last name is Cohen, but her last name was Mizrahi. And there was a moment where I was like, should I be Hadar Mizrahi now? Like, what does that mean? But then I also had to unpack, like, what is this Mizrahi word and how did that come to be? And I think that there's so much existential crisis that happens to Arab Jews, Jews from the Muslim world, Jews from Arab countries, Mizrahi Jews, however you want to call us. And I've certainly have had a process around learning how to reclaim my identity and who I really am. And yeah, I'm curious to hear a little bit more about that process of identifying, as you said, as a Muslim Jew or even as an Arab Jew, or, you know, your relationship to that word Mizrahi. Like, how did you come to claim that identity and what were some of the challenges along the way?
So thank you. It's really, I can go in different directions. Let's see what comes up first. So first of all, I would like to say something about, you know, I feel like, you know, the process that I went through or that I'm going through are more like processes of unlearning than learning. Because I feel like, you know, I was thrown into a world full of lies and full of constructions that are not mine, that I inhabited, you know, as if they were mine in certain ways, you know. And I feel like, you know, in retrospect, when I'm looking back, you know, at my very young age, it was constantly a process of unlearning. So I would like to start, you know, by this unlearning as something that motivates me or guides me. I prefer, I think, the term being guided by it. And the term Mizrahi, I'll be very curious to hear the story of the Mizrahi as a family name. But the category of Mizrahi, Mizrahim, Mizrahit was, you know, as long as I used to live in the Zionist colony in Palestine, this was the category that, you know, I inclined to use because, you know, we were not Ashkenazi Jew. We were certainly those who were inferiorized by the Ashkenazi Jews. But I was always, you know, I had a kind of, you know, discomfort with the category. But I, you know, it took me years to unlearn, to understand why I don't like this category. And I think that only when I left the Zionist colony and I started to understand that actually this is a Zionist invention. Maybe I knew it earlier, but I didn't understand really the full meaning of what does it mean that this is also a Zionist, you know, category. And in a way, the category of Mizrahi, which was, you know, for me, a category that I used, you know, to resist against the regime, to resist against the hegemony of the Ashkenazi European power in the colony. It is actually a category that was also used to say that this world from where we are coming is over. Now we are in this relationship vis-a-vis Ashkenazi Jew. Now we are in this relationship vis-a-vis Palestinians. So I realized that actually this category operated as another dissociator from the world of my ancestors. And this category was actually part of a caste system that was invented by European Zionists that decided for us, even before we were born, which kind of price or which kind of homage we are willing to pay to colonial powers, be it the British Empire or the French Empire. So they spoke on our behalf and promised, you know, this colonial power, give us Palestine and we will give our obedience to your imperial power. So they, you know, they sent us, in a way. We were, you know, the price, the sacrifice to build this, you know, insane colony in Palestine against Palestinians, against Jews of all sorts. But I will speak only about Jews coming from the Jewish Muslim world. So the category of Mizrahi started to feel really like, you know, part of the caste system that has a very short history, if we think about it, and there is no reason to continue to inhabit it. And, you know, there was this, you know, reclamation by, you know, El HaShochat, which I call it a reclamation because, you know, this is the way that Arab Jews related to themselves. And from the, you know, she comes from Iraq. And, you know, when you read, you know, writings of Iraqi Jews, this is the way that they spoke about themselves. But when it comes to North Africa, saying that I'm an Arab Jew is not enough. Because I don't even know if we are Arab Jews or if we are Berber Jews or if we are a mixture of both of them. And I'm not, by the way, very interested to know if we are exactly this or that. So it feels more, you know, coherent to relate to myself as a Muslim Jew. Because this is the world that, you know, my ancestors were part of for centuries. And even more than four centuries, you know, from the beginning of Islam, Jews were part of this world. So I don't see why I would relate to myself otherwise, and especially as this, you know, world or worldliness, to use, you know, Hannah Arendt's term, was deliberately destroyed by Europeans and European Jews from the beginning of the 18th century, even before the invention of the Zionist movement. And just one last thing is about the category of identity. I'm not sure that I speak about identity or that I want to speak about identity. I don't have a better term, by the way. But I think that I speak about belonging in or belongings rather than an identity, because identity, you know, with all the problematics that we know about identity, feels to me too much like a private property. And I feel that when I'm saying that I am a Muslim Jew, I'm part of a world that was deliberately destroyed, and I am committed to make it, to inhabit it, and to reclaim it, and to make it available to my descendants. Because, you know, in a way, I'm speaking about my ancestors, but I am an ancestor to my descendants. So, yeah, this world should be inhabited, not as identity that we carry, but as something that we reclaim should not have been destroyed.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. I was really moved by hearing you speak. And when you were talking about how part of the Zionist project was to erase so much of that world as if it's over, I just was feeling so much grief because, you know, growing up in the time that I grew up in, is it does feel like that was a narrative that I was sold. It's like you come from this place, but it was just completely erased and there's no way to get it back. But, you know, for me personally, when I started on my own reclamation journey of being like, okay, what does it look like to revive and reclaim? And it to me, first of all, just felt filled with a lot of grief and a lot of challenges, but also so much hope and beauty around, yeah, perhaps it's not lost actually, and perhaps it's all there and it's just waiting for us to return to it. So I wanted to ask if you could share a little bit more about what you mean when you say the Muslim Jewish world and, yeah, what is it that we are reclaiming?
Yeah, so, you know, I use the term reclaiming, but I think that I feel more, you know, comfortable with the term inhabiting, because I don't know exactly what I'm reclaiming, but I'm reclaiming the condition under which, you know, my ancestor lived in the Jewish Muslim world. But I will try, you know, to reply from a different perspective. You know, when oftentimes we experience many of the imperial crimes against us as a family romance, right? As if we have some problems with our parents because either they became Zionists or they didn't transmit to us many things. So there is, you know, I think that, you know, if we go back to the question about beginnings, there were different moments when I felt like, Father, Abba, why didn't you transmit me this? Why did you hide from me the name of Aisha? Why didn't you take me to a journey in Algeria? But you know, there is a moment in this process of unlearning where I understand that it's not about, you know, blaming my father. It's about understanding what he was unable to see when so much was taken from him, and how I can, rather than, you know, being in a dispute with him or with my mother, how can I show them what they were unable to see because of the, you know, the specific, you know, configuration in time and space that they inhabited, or because of the specific, you know, imperial crimes committed against them. And the question is how I can share with them the same grounding in my anti-colonial, in the anti-colonial, you know, discourse or practices, and in inhabiting this world. So rather than expecting and, you know, mourning that my father or my mother didn't transmit what they should have transmitted, what I'm trying to do is to inhabit spaces where I feel I was removed from. So coming back to your question about the Jewish Muslim world and what does it mean to inhabit it? You know, when a few years ago, as I was researching, you know, many things about Algeria, and I didn't know where to go. So I went in all directions. I encounter, you know, a fact that I have no idea how come that I didn't know, which is that the Jews were the jewelers of the Ummah, which means that since the very beginning of the Islam, Jews were there, right? It's not that the Jews were invited, join us. They were there. And the deal between the Jews and the Muslims were that the Jews will take care of working with precious metals. First of all, they are full of power. They are really very, very powerful. And it's scary. And also precious metals are related, you know, to benefit that you can make out of, you know, money, the equivalent of money. So there were, you know, several agreements, local agreements, broader agreements, and Jews continued. And this is the way that they were integrated into the Ummah at the very beginning of Islam as the jewelers. So when I learned this and I saw that, wow, they were the jewelers in North Africa, Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, in the Middle East, Yemen, all over, this is what the Jews did. While in Europe, they were, you know, not allowed to deal with many of the professions. So it really blew my mind. And as maybe in relation to one of your earlier question, how I came to do film and to make archives and to write, I don't relate to text that I'm writing as the only way that I have to articulate what I'm doing. Whenever I feel like, you know, it requires other modes of engagement in the world or being in the world, I do it. So what I did immediately when I discovered this is starting to copy pieces of jewelry the Jews did in North Africa, mainly in Algeria. And I'm not a jeweler. I don't have any, you know, training as a jeweler. But there was no reason that I will not believe that my hand carry muscular memory of this profession that was prevalent for the Jews. So I started to rehearse my hands to be able to copy several models, you know, of jewelry. So this for me means, you know, to inhabit the Jewish Muslim world. So it's also, you know, it's a reclamation, but it's not a reclamation as an identity that now I want to be a jeweler. It's inhabiting a practice, refusing to forget. I think that many of my modalities of thinking about, you know, inhabiting are related to a refusal to forget, a refusal to be dissociated from, a refusal let my body live only or experience only all the lies that, you know, since before I was born even, were attributed to me as my identity. And I must say also, you know, from a different perspective, you know, the refusal, for example, to recognize myself in the category of Israeli or the category of Mizrahi, that were the categories that were assigned to me. The first one, the Israeli at birth. The second one, whenever I opened my mouth, whenever I was in the company of non-North African Jews. And these categories, you know, they are create, you know, in the same way that, you know, trans people speak about dysphoria, they create a dysphoria. And this dysphoria was the guidance, the compass for unlearning. So it's unlearning, it's refusing, it's reproducing the gestures that my ancestors, you know, practiced. It's awakening muscular memory. All this is part of the way that I'm trying to inhabit this world.
I love that. And I very much relate. I mean, so my family comes from Jerusalem. We've been in Jerusalem for 10 generations, you know, and I'm Jewish. But yeah, that term that was kind of put on me is that, oh, you're Israeli. But, you know, that process of Israelification feels so violent because it actually feels so foreign from what I actually was. But it also feels like there isn't really a permission to be anything else given the current political reality. And I think for me, in my personal journey around claiming myself as an Arab Jew, you know, one of the things that I liked about that identity is that it wasn't so much about nostalgic, about looking at the past and living in the past, but it also is prophetic around, well, what do we want the future to be? And am I willing to just let, you know, my whole lineage disappear? or do I have some say here? And yeah, I'm just kind of touched by so much of your work around that. And I guess I wanted to ask a little, if you can speak a little bit about, because so much of your work is about anti-colonialism and understanding the violence of these systems. And just wanted to hear you speak a little bit about what you think the impact of that Israelification that was done onto our communities, onto, you know, Muslim Jews, Arab Jews, Mizrahi Jews, the camp of however we want to identify.
Yeah. So, you know, I started to touch on it a little bit, you know, when I said that I'm refusing to recognize myself in this assigned identity. You said that your family is several generations from Jerusalem, so it is very likely that your family knew my family from my mother's side when they, you know, for generations, they, you know, some of them, those were more, you know, rabbi, they went to Palestine to die there. And they moved in between, you know, the Ottoman Empire, in between different places. My ancestors from my mother family moved to Jerusalem prior to the Zionist migrations or infiltrations, or I don't know, you can call them, we can call them however we like. And they moved to Jerusalem and they lived in Jerusalem. And at a certain moment, you know, prior to the Israelification, there was the Zionification of those, you know, Jews who were part of this, you know, Ottoman world from my mother's side. And there were, you know, lands that were offered to be purchased by the Baron in Rishon LeZion. And this is the moment when, you know, the family moved from Jerusalem, from, you know, this kind of ordinary practice of, you know, some of the members of different families to go to Palestine for a certain time, not to inhabit it, maybe to die there and to go back. But, you know, the Zionists were already there and money was started to organize the mind of people, corporations, Jewish corporations. Because, you know, when we speak about Jews in Europe, when we speak about Zionists, we also have to make a differentiation between, you know, very rich capitalist Jews who invested money in Palestine, like the British invested money in Palestine prior to the British mandate. So I think that before the Israelization, there was the Anglicization from the, you know, the Anglican church that wanted to convert the Jews in Jerusalem. They opened, you know, an office to convert the Jews in the early 19th century in Jerusalem. Because, you know, the idea was that the Jews will, you know, lead the redemption of the Holy Land. So, and following the Zionist, because, you know, many of the Jews, even those who migrated to Palestine, were not necessarily Zionist. But where it comes, you know, to my paternal family in North Africa, you know, one of the states that really resisted Zionism, they really didn't want to hear about this bullshit, was Algeria. But they tried and tried and they tried, and they couldn't, you know, convince them. And in 48, you know, the Nakba, the destruction of Palestine and the imposition of the State of Israel. And my father, who lived, you know, the family for generation lived in Algeria, is coming back from Second World War. And Algeria was the European Algeria was very anti-Jews. And he comes back from the war when he fought, you know, with the Africa army, like, you know, all other colonized, you know, Muslim and Jews, because this was the moment when also they took the citizenship away from the Jews. And they fought in Second World War because the idea was that you fight for freedom of everybody. And he comes back to Algeria and he couldn't find himself there because, you know, Algeria continued to be very anti-Semite. So we went for 1 year to all the colony was already transformed into a sovereign settler state, Israel, in 49. And he went there for 1 year and he met my mother and he decided to stay rather than to go back after 1 year. I don't know where he was hoping to arrive to Canada, where they also speak French. So my father that, you know, was grew up with, you know, a father who was an anarchist, who was a unionist, who was a Jewish butcher in Algeria. It was not taken by Zionism at any moment. At this moment in the late 40s, this seems to me to him like, you know, an adventure that he could take. And he understood it because of the Zionist propaganda as the continuation of the fight for the Jews. To protect the Jews. So this Israelization captured my father and he stayed there and we were born. And I could say, luckily, my father hated the state. He never felt, you know, part of this place. And this is a legacy that I reclaim today without my father really rejecting everything that is Israeli, not from a leftist perspective at all, from a perspective that he just, I think that he just, you know, rehearsed his muscular, you know, anti-colonial understanding of what is a state. And this state seems like a settler state for someone who is coming from Algeria. So he was not pro-Palestinian, but he was anti the colonial state without being capable to articulate it. He was not educated. He, you know, studied 6 years and... So a very long journey to say that the Israelification is, in my case, is two generations. It's my father that was captured into it. It's my mother who at the age of 17, they destroyed beloved Palestine. And she became Israeli. And all her, you know, all the legacy that she spoke still, you know, Ladino with her mother and all the, you know, the secrets that they carried within the language in Ladino, she couldn't transmit to me because she will not raise her children in Ladino in Palestine. But for herself, she kept it as her mother tongue that she continued to speak with her mother. So the Israelification of my parents and then my Israelification that was before I was born, right? I was, you know, cursed to be born an Israeli, but I break the curse because I also believe in mysticism, spiritualism, and my power to say no.
Amen. Yes to that. I'm with you on that. And, you know, one of the things that I am struck by, especially in the West, sometimes when, you know, the West is kind of looking over and looking at what's happening, there's this narrative of it's like, oh, well, it's Jews fighting Muslims. And, you know, for me in my political development, I started understanding how the Israelification and the state of Israel was very much also perpetuating this like Western war on Islam. And, you know, as being, you know, an Arab Jew myself or an Islamic Jew or a Muslim Jew, however you want to name it, it's like there feels like such a rupture inside. And I guess I wanted to ask you, what is your relationship to Islam? And, you know, this is coming from also my question to myself, where I live in Los Angeles right now, and we're in the beginning of the Ramadan season. We just started Ramadan as we are recording this podcast. And I just am struck that I am the first in my lineage to live in a Christian dominant society. Like my bones, my muscular knowing, it doesn't actually understand that. It's very used to, you know, having Islam being the dominant religion and having, you know, Ramadan celebrations everywhere. So all of a sudden living in this like Christian Western state is actually really foreign. But so it's just, it's creating like a lot of these like internal questions. And yeah, I just wanted to ask you what your relationship to Islam and what does that mean for you in that process of inhabiting in the Jewish Muslim world while being in the Christian state. And I know that's a big question, but these are some of the workings of my mind.
Yeah, no, it's a crucially important question. It's a crucially important question because of the condition under which we live. You know, I think that, you know, earlier you asked me at the very beginning what led me to this work. And I know I picked up one beginning. But I think that I should add to this that, you know, when I moved to the U.S. 10 years ago, which was really immediately after my father passed away, I was, wow, no, I am not a European Jew. And the assumption that I am a European Jew, because, you know, my skin color is lighter than my father's skin color. But, you know, all my life I lived, you know, as the black Jew of the white Jews in this system of caste. And all of a sudden, coming to the U.S. and to this part, I'm not speaking about, you know, the other coast, the West Coast, but in the East Coast, they have no idea. What does it mean? So I have, at the beginning, you know, I had patience and I explained. But, you know, after a certain time, I don't want to, no longer want to explain. So, I rehearse certain provocations, right? To make clear that, you know, you have to educate yourself. I am not here to educate you forever. But it, so many assumptions about who you are if you're a Jew here. And, you know, this created an urgency to put forward like a barrier who I am. And the immediate answers were, you know, I am what was taken from me. And what was taken from me is the Jewish Muslim world. It's not Jewish and Muslim. So I didn't go to look what is Islam for me or what is Jewishness for me, because, you know, I grew up in the Zionist colony. In the Zionist colony, the last thing that you are is a Jew. You're actually a Christian Jew. In the Zionist colony, because the state itself is a Zionist structure, is a Christian structure. It is based on, you know, settler colonial state. There are white Christian states. It's, you know, the scale. We must understand the scale, I think, of the state. So the last thing that I was in the colony is a Jew, because, you know, Israel really smashed everything that is Jew in order to create this new species, which are the Israeli Jew or the Zionist. This is a new species. It didn't exist. So as you said, all my body remembers with my ancestors that we were surrounded by Muslims when we celebrated our, you know, holidays, when we did, whenever we did. When, you know, Ramadan met, you know, Pesach at certain, you know, years, because, you know, there are two different calendars that do not match the Gregorian calendar. But sometimes they meet, you know, in the spring together. And it's exciting because, you know, of whatever we learn about this. And you ask, what is my relationship to Islam? So I would like to use, you know, this term of relationship. I relate to Islam as something that is related to my Judaism. So it's not Islam for itself, it's Islam in its relationship to Judaism. Because actually, Islam never existed without Judaism. And as far as I can, you know, imagine my ancestors, I can go, you know, to the moment when they were, you know, they had to negotiate their place in the Ummah. And their place in the Ummah is something that I think is very important to think with. Because, you know, unlike the way that European discourse of freedom. And, you know, in my background, I also studied, you know, French Revolution and the invention of modern citizenship, etc. And, you know, the invention of modern citizenship, which was, you know, white Christian male citizenship, was given to the Jews fairly quickly after it was given to Christian French. And it was given to them as a bargain. They were forced to convert to secularism, to French understanding of secularism, which means that they got protection as individual, not as community, which means that in order to become citizens, the Jews in France had to be dissociated from their community, which means that the French deliberately destroyed Jewish communities that were built all over France, you know, as, you know, clusters of families, always more than 10 families in order to have minyan. And they were spread, you know, in different places in France. And French Revolution discourse of citizenship actually targeted this Jewish formation, this Jewish autonomy, and Jews started to get, you know, protection as individual. This is the beginning of the process of emancipation, with big quotation mark, emancipation of the Jews, that the Napoleonic War that, you know, followed from the French Revolution, went to Europe, emancipated the Jews with quotation mark in Europe. Then they went to Egypt and they targeted the Jewish community there alongside the Muslim communities. And then a few decades later, they colonized Algeria and they came already with converted Jews, converted to French secularism, who wanted to regenerate my ancestors. But when they wanted to regenerate my ancestors, they also, these were the French Jews. The French wanted to regenerate also Muslims, but they said this is a failed case. So they targeted Berber and they Berber Muslims, Berber Jews, and Arab Jews. So my relationship to Islam is throughout, you know, this idea that under the Islam, the Dhimmi contract was, you know, protection of Jewish communities and not protection of individuals. So we have here a different model, not a model to take for granted as is, but a model to unlearn the notion that Jews should be protected by empire, by white Christian empire as individuals, and to reclaim the possibility to imagine Jewish communities surrounded by Muslim communities. So all these, you know, questions about, you know, Islam and Judaism provoke also, you know, my other hat, which is a political theorist. So I'm trying to understand what would it mean to claim, you know, the Ummah as the place where we belong. And as a little exercise, what I'm trying to do here at Brown is to think about, you know, madrasa bet midrash or synagogue, mosque, not as a format of coexistence or reconciliation. We have nothing to reconcile. We have the urgency to create the condition, exactly in response to what you said, the condition where, you know, we share a space as Jews and Muslims, rather than being Jews in a white Christian society.
That was excellent. Thank you. That gave me so much to think about. And yeah, really appreciate all your framing. Taya, I'll pass it to you.
Ariella, Aisha, this is Taya. I'm so moved by all that you share here. I want to ask you to speak a bit to A World Like a Jewel in Your Hand, your new movie. First, let's listen.
We have to start with this ball, the earth. What does it mean that we hold it in our hands? It's not just conquering other lands, slowly, slowly moving forward. It's this fantasy that we have a conception of the whole. It's this fantasy that we know the earth. And if we know the earth, those imperial actors, they are taking scissors and they are starting to cut. They cut languages, they cut property, they separate people from their objects, they separate people from their spirits, they are separating people from their family. They are pitting one against the others in creating the body politic. So this fantasy of the earth as something that you understand its wholeness is at the basis of the imperial project.
Amazing. Ariella, Aisha, tell us about what we're listening to. Tell us about this film.
So this film is the second in a trilogy. The first one was Undocumented, Unlearning Imperial Plunder. And I would like to start with the first one in the trilogy. It was about, it was an attempt to look at looted objects that are in European museums, in Germany, in France, in England, in Belgium, and to look at these looted objects rather than as works of art or rather than as objects, as the documents that, you know, the international political system of empire tells us are missing from those that the imperial powers are calling undocumented. Those people who don't have documents, hence they can be let drone in the Mediterranean. Hence they can be shot in the borders when they are approaching different, you know, countries illegally with quotation marks because they don't have the documents. So what I'm trying to do, you know, in my political theory work and in the film, in the first one, in the trilogy, is trying to undermine, to unsettle this separation between documents and objects and show that actually all these looted objects belong to those who are seeking for asylum. When they are coming from prior, you know, former colonies to Europe, actually they are reclaiming a proximity to their objects. And these objects that were well documented in the museum storage, they are their documents. So it's an attempt to reimagine our relationship to looted objects, rather than, you know, relating to them, appreciate them as, you know, universal museum goers. It's an attempt to say, first of all, we don't have a right to look at them that way. These are objects belong to those people who are reclaiming access to our former colonial powers state. And, you know, from this came the second film. And the second film, The World Like a Jewel in the Hand, is an attempt to unlearn the way that we relate to objects when we enter the museum. So it's an attempt to say, listen, what you appreciate around is actually an imperial crime. Modernity is an imperial crime. All these objects that I was, you know, trained to love are looted from other people. And while in the first film, I was still incapable, you know, in analogy to what I said earlier about potential history, I was still incapable to approach objects that were taken from my ancestors. This film is about, you know, Palestine and Algeria. And it's an attempt to understand how come that these practices that, as you know, from childhood, we are being trained to appreciate education, curiosity for other cultures, going to museums to appreciate objects. All this is entangled with imperial crimes. So what does it mean that our body was trained to love, and my body was trained to love objects in museums? And I saw it, you know, for me, it was a way to, for an upward mobility, I would even say it, you know, cynically or not. Because, you know, as I grew up as a Mizrahi Jew in the colony, I was, you know, in the lower echelon of the ladder. So, you know, train myself to go to museums, to engage with art was, you know, like being, you know, recognized by others that I am worthy to be in conversation with. And how come that all these, you know, practices that I incorporated are actually part of empire. What does it mean that empire works through me? That empire operates through me? Whenever I like or appreciate something, it is actually keeping other people to whom these objects belong at bay. So the world like a jewel in the hand is an attempt to look at Palestine and Algeria as part of the global imperial project. And why do I say a global imperial project in relation to the title? Because the global imperial project is when the imperial powers, the colonizers, they held the world in their hand and they thought that now they have a picture of the whole and they can distribute it among themselves like a trophy. So the film starts from this idea that the world is a trophy of those colonial powers and this is really the arc of the film. It ends when I bring back, you know, the world to my heart, where I, you know, inhabit the world with others and we say, don't dare to tell us.
This is so amazing, Ariella Aisha, to hear what you are offering. I'm curious, for our listeners who are new to a process of unlearning, what would you invite? How can folks begin or deepen in their unlearning? What are the questions to ask? What lens to gaze through?
I believe that people are already in the process of unlearning. Sometimes they refuse to recognize it because it's too scary. So what I would say is, don't be scared. There are others who are doing, you know, who are going through the same processes. And we were born into an imperial world, so we have to unlearn each and every, I don't know, inch in our body, each and every, you know, word that we are using when we put together a sentence. So I don't have, you know, advice to give, but just to maybe share, you know, my belief that this is what we have to do. And we cannot unlearn empire without unlearning how we were shaped by empire. And maybe I'll give an example. You know, in the first film in the trilogy, The Undocumented, I did it in a polemic dialogue with a film that is very formative for people who are studying, you know, art or cinema. It is called Statue Also Die. It is considered to be a kind of anti-colonial French film from the 49, I think, or 48, done by Alain René and Chris Marker. And the entire film is shot in museums and it shows you, you know, objects. Many of them were looted. And they have, you know, a kind of authoritative voiceover that tells us the story of these objects by saying that statues also die, right? This is part of the botany of the museum. And statues do not die. Either they are being murdered or they are still there awaiting for the people who will come to reclaim them. So my film has been shot also only within museum, no talking heads. You see only objects and the objects refuse to die. The objects are there awaiting for their people to reclaim them. Why do I say this? Because Alain René and Chris Marker, that are, you know, both very talented, you know, cinematographer, like many of the French, you know, philosophers that I used to read many, many years ago, and I used even to translate some of them into Hebrew, they don't ask questions about their position as children of empire. So holding an anti-colonial discourse without unlearning how you were formed by empire is not a process of unlearning. Is learning an anti-colonial discourse, but it doesn't do the work that I feel is required. So if you insist on any advice, I would say that the unlearning must, you know, engage also unlearning how each of us was, you know, formed by empire into different positions. And even for myself, you know, for years I spent, you know, time unlearning how I was formed as, you know, a perpetrator, because holding or inhabiting the Israeli citizenship was, or to be an Israeli citizen in Palestine, in the Zionist colony, meant to be, you know, a weapon against Palestinians to prevent them from returning to their homeland. So I unlearned this position also, which is the position of the perpetrator. And I unlearned it not in order to withdraw from, you know, commitment to struggle with Palestinians, the Palestinian struggle to see Palestine return. Unlearning it meant to unlearn how did we come there that, you know, in 48, they forced all the Jews in Palestine to become Zionist and to become a side in this, what they invented as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with big quotation marks, because this was not a conflict. This was the imposition of a settler colonial state that forced Jews to become Zionist. And the resistance to Zionism prior to World War II is a story that was not transmitted to us. You read, you know, Cyril Shirzi in Egypt, you read, you know, anti-colonialists, you know, all over the Muslim world, and they speak more eloquently than I can write, you know, any anti-Zionist text today. But these stories were not transmitted to us, deliberately were taken from us. So the advice is to unlearn how we were, you know, shaped by empire.
In a world like A Jewel in the Hand, you speak of knowledge as the permission to violate everything. And you speak of the expulsion of Jews and Muslims, and that their burning books was another way of leaving scorched earth behind. Could you say more about that?
So, yeah, I think that, you know, I want to go back to the French Revolution, because I really see it like, you know, in my context. I think that, you know, people coming from the Jewish Muslim world that was colonized by the British have a different trajectory maybe to go through. But my trajectory really starts with the French Revolution. And I find it, you know, like a sign that somehow, by pure coincidence, I became a scholar of the French Revolution way before I decided to, you know, to go back to my origins and to study Algeria. And why do I want to go to the French Revolution? Because, you know, part of the ideology of the French Revolution was, you know, freedom. They had the best idea of freedom. They invented citizenship. They invented the Declaration of, you know, Rights of Man and Citizen. And they invented public education. And this is, you know, something that, you know, is being cherished by many in different places, and something that allegedly we have to defend, right? Because all this discourse that knowledge is very important. Schools are very important. But, you know, and this should become universal rights. It's not that I want to be against knowledge, but all this is part of an imperial ideology that destroyed so many formation of knowledge in order to impose its own understanding of knowledge as necessary. So wherever they went, they said they lack knowledge. We have to educate them. So what they did, and I would like to insist on craft, because you asked me about, you know, the film, and the film is about, you know, the destruction of craft in Algeria, in North Africa, in French colonies. So wherever they go, the French, when they colonized, you know, Algeria, they suck the knowledge of different types of craft, and they impose schools for poor little girls to use, actually, their, you know, very thin, malleable, dexterous, you know, fingers to weave for them, you know, rags, to weave for them different types of tapestry in sweatshops. These are sweatshops, and they call it schools. So you have, you know, in the film I showed, you know, a variety of postcards that were, you know, taken in these, you know, so-called schools, sweatshops, again, for little girls, that they teach them their ancestral craft, because embroidery was something that, you know, mainly women, they did, you know, from a very young age, but they didn't have, you know, to do it through the mechanization of their hands, through, you know, working in sweatshops for several hours a day, every day during the week. They did it, you know, as part of bliss moment with their female ancestors, several female ancestors. This is something that they learned because, you know, you needed new tapestry at home. You needed, you know, there was a newborn. You wanted to envelop them, you know, in something. So this was part of the education. And the French came, they said that now they have to educate these girls because they are ignorant. So they suck the knowledge that they have, they mechanize it, they industrialize it, they capitalize it, imperialize it, colonize it, and give it to the girls. So when I'm speaking in the film about, you know, scorched earth, I'm trying to juxtapose different moments related to books. Because, you know, there is this discourse, oh, when they burn books, what will come after? So first of all, it will not come after. Usually it came before. Because, you know, they burn people before they burn books. And with the expulsion from Spain, what we see, you know, with the emergence of, you know, the Catholic state that expelled and converted Jews and Muslims, they burned many books. And when they left Algeria, the French, they burned many books. At the same time, there was this discourse of we have to rescue what the books that the Nazi plundered. So there is something in the film about, you know, the way that our property that was stolen from European Jews had to be restituted. And we have, you know, this kind of understanding that the Nazi absolved themselves by, you know, reparations and restitutions. But, you know, Gisha Meet show it, I think, very brilliantly in his book that, you know, many of the books that were, you know, restored from the Nazi, looting, were actually restituted to two institutions that had no claim to have them. One of them is the National Library in Jerusalem, and the other one is the Library of Congress in Washington. And very few books were left in Europe for the survivors of the Holocaust. So rather than building Jewish communities in Europe, their books were taken by those who came to liberate them. And the other case that I'm dealing with is the case of Palestine, that what you see immediately after the expulsion from Palestine, you see, you know, these international humanitarian agency, they are giving books to Palestinians. And I'm asking in the film, why do they give books to Palestinians? Why do they educate Palestinians? They were highly educated. They had so many libraries. So you take the book, you destroy the condition for them to continue their own formations of producing knowledge, and then you transform the right to knowledge or the right to books into a universal right that only imperial power can secure, allegedly. So yeah, the film deals with this, you know, paradox, not paradox, this, you know, series of contradictions, how many ways of producing knowledge were destroyed while only one was cherished, which goes through books, which goes through imperial education, which goes through universal, you know, terms. And we know that people are reclaiming all the time, resisting this erasure. But when it comes to knowledge, the right to knowledge, or to justify many crimes by knowledge, we have to resist and reclaim other formations.
You've spoken about parallel ways that Jewish and Muslim cultures have been erased and colonized. What do you see as parallels between ways that we adapt, transform, and thrive?
I think that, you know, from different direction, different people are asking questions about what was taken from them. And they arrive when it comes, for example, to Algeria. I don't want to speak in general about Muslim and Jews. I want to speak about Algeria. I hear it from, you know, many of my Algerian Muslim friends. They speak with terms of amputation. And, you know, we see it in different, you know, films that have been, you know, done about, you know, how the Jews were kidnapped from the Jewish Muslim world. And you hear, you know, many people mourning this, you know, evaporation from one day to the next. Because Jews didn't migrate, you know, slowly over years. They were, you know, kidnapped in mass. So just, you know, yesterday, there was the first epistolary exchange between me and the Algerian poetess. Poetess, how do you say it in English? Female poet. And it's the first, you know, in a series of three rounds of letter exchange between us around this question of what was taken from us when the Jews were actually, you know, expelled from Algeria. And it's very deep what was taken from us. And it encounters us in very painful and exciting moments of understanding that actually, you know, for example, part of what happened to Algeria at the moment of independence, of the moment of liberation, of the moment of decolonization in 62, where, you know, I celebrated with Algerian, 62 is the year when, you know, they defeat the French. But on the other hand, at this moment of independence, actually, Algerian agreed to become, in a way, you know, imperial agent and to reshape the body politics and to accept that for the first time in the history of Islam, the Jews will not be protected under the Muslim Ummah, under the Ummah. And this is a tragic moment, I think, for Jews and Muslims. So some Jews went through processes of, you know, Zionization in the Zionist colony in Palestine, even though only 25% of Algerian Jews at the moment of, you know, their expulsion from Algeria went to the colony. The other 75% went either to France or Canada. And there they went also through processes, some of them, processes of Zionization, because the State of Israel compelled many Jews around the world to take a position, right, and imposed itself not only as speaking on behalf of the Jews, but as, you know, the destiny of the Jews. So in this exchange with Samira Negrush, we are trying to touch on these, you know, questions. This exchange is on the website of Rodbo Creek, where, you know, my text, two of my texts were will be published in May in a book, The Resistance of Jewelry, in French, but a condensed version or an assembled version of the three letters that I wrote to Samira Negrush will be part of my book, The Jewelers of the Ummah, Algerian Letters, that will come up in, you know, autumn 2024 at Verso. So it could be read there in English in 1 year.
Amazing. I'm excited for our listeners to find your work online. If you want to watch A World Like a Jewel in the Hand, you can reach out to Ariella directly. One more question before we come to close. Will you tell us about Madrasa Beit Midrash, a Muslim, Jewish, Arab, Amazigh space of spiritual and anti-colonial learning?
Yeah. So, you know, in the same way that I said earlier, rather than expecting that, you know, I don't know, what was not transmitted to me will pop up by itself, the idea that I can inhabit it, it felt like, you know, at the university where I am, it's true to other universities in the US, there is no space for Jews and Muslims to be together. And for Jews and Muslims to be together, but, you know, under this condition, not as a kind of encounter between Jews and Muslims. Now, for example, you know, how we can, you know, make, how can we weave together our anti-colonial imaginaries? How we can weave together our reclamation of a world pre the brutal colonial separation between the secular and the religious that actually left us without spaces, because, for example, the space of the synagogue or the space of the Beit Midrash became, you know, a religious space, the same for the mosque and the madrasa. So how can we reclaim? And, you know, when I'm speaking about, you know, inhabiting or reclaiming, I'm persuaded that pre-colonial formations should be inhabited and reclaimed and transformed as part of inhabiting them. So it's not that I believe that we have to take them as they were, but we must reclaim those formations and not invent new ones, because these formations, we have to change them. They were smashed, destroyed, and transformed by colonialism. We have to inhabit them in order to make them fit our aspirations. So, for example, in synagogues, you know, in the 18th century, there were workshops of weavers because, you know, part of the idea of making tzedakah, of giving, you know, some offering to other members of the community during the holidays involved producing these objects, crafting these objects. So workshops were part of it. The synagogue was a space, or the Bet Midrash was a space not only for learning, but a space for, you know, communal gathering. And as I'm very implicated in the question of restitution of objects in connection to the museum, I think that we cannot imagine, you know, our reclamation of Jewish and Muslim objects without imagining a space where they become meaningful again. Because you have, you know, a museum of Islamic art, you have a museum of Jewish art. But what about the space where we can imagine how these objects become meaningful again as part of the way that we share the space together? So it became, you know, Jewish, Muslim, Amazir, Arab, because, you know, these are the categories with which, you know, we have to engage with as a space that the white Christian university doesn't provide for us.
I understand that you work with the embodied practice of jewelry making as a way to reactivate ancestral muscle memory and knowledge. Can you tell us about this?
First of all, it's an attempt not to limit, you know, what I'm doing to texts. I don't think that the format of a text that starts and ends at a certain point is the only format to access what was taken from us. And I think that what was taken from us, we still have it in our bodies. Memories that we can reclaim, memories that are inscribed in our muscles, memories that are inscribed in fragments of information, memories that are inscribed in others, in other people that we can, you know, exchange with them, but they are also our memories. So, you know, reproducing some pieces of jewelry that are coming from Algeria or the Maghreb in general is for me a way to meditate through, you know, this kind of repetitive action of, you know, drilling, you know, holes in coins or beating them together, or trying to struggle with how to move the feel, the threads in between, you know, the different pieces. Well, when I don't have any training in jewelry making, is for me, an embodied resistance to forget. And it started, you know, when I ask myself, you know, many questions about what does it mean that I was colonized, you know, by the French. I was colonized by the Zionist, but I was also colonized by art. And we spoke about it a little bit earlier. And what does it mean that I was colonized by art? It means that all the knowledge that I actually acquired at home was irrelevant when I went to study art. I had to forget it. And I asked myself, my father grew up until the age of 29 in Algeria, right? Why do I tell myself that I don't know what does it mean to learn from a Muslim Jew anything about art? And I started to ask myself, what did I learn from my father who had very talented hands? But his hands were used mainly to repair things. My father would never leave something broken. But this was irrelevant because, you know, the ideology of art schools, and this is part of the colonization, being colonized by art, the ideology of art school is that you have to invent something new. And my father, you know, dexterous hands were, you know, invested in repairing. So through this, you know, practice of reproducing pieces of jewelry without training was really a very spiritual, I would say, you know, immersion in reverse transmission. It was not directly transmitted to me, but I can still retrace what was transmitted to me without being said that. And this, you know, helped me to see many fascinating things. For example, a flashback, the first day that when I went to, you know, to a jewelry workshop, you know, kind of 3 hours, and I, you know, I had to use the torch. All of a sudden, I was reminded of my father. When I was really very, very young, he used to repair radio. You know, and the radio were big, you know, wooden boxes. And within it, you have many, many, many metal threads, very, very thin one. And he used, you know, a kind of, I don't know how you call it in English, malchem, to sutter together, you know, metallic, you know, thread. And I asked myself, and I knew this story. I knew that my father, when he was 13, approximately, he learned by correspondence how to become a radio technician. We're speaking about the mid-30s or late-30s. So he received, you know, every once in a while, you know, a package, or, you know, from Paris or from France to Algeria, and he learned how to practice, you know, to become a radio technician. And then I asked myself, but, you know, you cannot become a radio technician without using metal thread, because otherwise you cannot, you know, connect something to let, you know, the wave to transmit, you know, sound. And all of a sudden I understood that, you know, he should have gone to, you know, the jewelers around the corner that were mostly Jews, and to ask from them, you know, some materials, some advice. So actually I feel like, you know, I can even trace through these processes of unlearning, trace how this knowledge was transmitted to me. So it's a non, you know, positivist way of, you know, tracing. It's more embodied way of saying so much was taken from me, even the possibility to see myself as a descendant of someone who was a descendant of others who practiced, you know, different modes of engaging with precious metal.
Thank you so much, Ariella Aisha, for all that you have shared here. It's such a blessing to be in conversation with you and with Hadar. Will you close us with a prayer?
Yeah, you know, I ask myself, what should I share with you as a prayer? And I thought at the beginning, you know, going back to Agar, when, you know, Hajar, when she goes with Ishmael and there is no longer water, and she is sitting and she raises her voice, Vatisa kola vatevch, and she's praying, right? And she's praying and her voice is being heard, even though the text tells us that it's the cry of the of Ishmael that is being heard. But then I thought that maybe I'll share with you something else. So something that I wrote for the film, because we talked a lot about the film. So I would like to share with you a prayer that is in the film. Don't dare to tell us we cannot talk like this. No, don't dare. You silenced our ancestor until you pressed them to live a world in which we could not be born. Don't dare to tell us it was their choice, as if they wanted to ruin the world their ancestors shared with Muslims. Don't dare to tell us that their wish was to see beloved Palestine ruined. We will not let you bury us alive in your museums, where our ancestors' world, which should have been ours, are piled in your acclimatized halls, dedicated to extinct species, Afghan Jews, Algerian Jews, Egyptian Jews, Yemeni Jews, Iranian Jews, Iraqi Jews, Tunisian Jews. So if I can close with a prayer, is that those diverse Jewish forms of belonging to the Muslim world will be inhabited by as many as we can imagine. And this is a way to undo the part of, you know, the Christian way to destroy the world to which we belonged for centuries.
Amen. Can you hear that sound? Inshallah, may it be so.
Inshallah, amen.
Amen. Thank you so much for that beautiful prayer. So moving, and may it be so.
Ariella Aisha, thank you. This has been such an exquisite conversation. It's such a joy, Hadar, to weave with you. I was so moved by all that you asked and that whole aspect of conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, likewise. It's really such a honor. And I'm just so struck by the weaving of politics and spirituality and belonging and all and ancestors and lineage and just the weaving through all of these different lenses to think about who we are as people. And I was just really touched and moved by this conversation, and really such a pleasure to interview you. I've been following your work again for so long, and just so grateful for all the work that you do, not just for yourself, but also for people like me who, you know, come from a younger generation, but now have a feel to look into and to not feel so alone in that process. So yeah, thank you. Thank you for all that you offer us.
Thank you. Thank you both for asking me, you know, these questions and guiding me in this space. And I love so much your work. So it's really a pleasure and an honor to be here with you. So thank you.